May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ian Brendel. I represent La Tanisha Rogers in this appeal. Here with me today is Carlos Moore. He will not be arguing, however, he has assisted. He's at the table. I raised 12 issues in Ms. Rogers' brief. Of course, this was a Medicare fraud trial. There was a voluminous transcript. I don't think I'm going to be able to address all 12 today, but I selected a few for the panel that I'd like to go over. The first issue that I raised in my brief, the first issue that I want to address today, was the ineffective assistance of counsel issue. Now, at the outset, I acknowledge, Ms. Rogers acknowledged, that they're generally disfavored on direct appeal. Nonetheless, this court can consider ineffective assistance of counsel claims when the record is sufficiently developed. And in this particular case, I believe that it is. The particular parts of the record that I believe are developed for this court to address the ineffective assistance of counsel claim are the first 10 of 11 exhibits that were introduced by the government. The government called as their first witness Ms. Heather Shepherd. Ms. Shepherd was an employee of Cahaba. Cahaba is a third-party administrator of Medicare benefits. She is not a representative of Medicare. She is not a representative of Medicaid. She is not a representative for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. Nonetheless, as the sponsor of those exhibits, for example, and I'll start with exhibits 1 through 3. Exhibits 1 through 3 that the government introduced as Ms. Shepherd as a sponsor were a carrier manual authored by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. They were admitted without objection.
Now, given, of course, it's your time to argue like you want to, but you only have 7 minutes and you got a bunch of issues. So if you start taking us through every piece of evidence, you know, get too much argument. My question is, you're leading off with ineffective counsel as your preeminent issue. Is that what you're arguing to us as your strongest issue?
I don't know if it's necessarily the strongest issue, but I think it's one that needs to be addressed based on the fact that this evidence that was introduced was used in the government's closing that I believe convicted Ms. Rogers or was a substantial part in convicting Ms. Rogers.
Was counsel retained or
appointed? No, Your Honor, appointed. And had the objections been made, it's my position they should have been sustained had they been made. And
well, let me just ask you, suppose the objection had been made, what leads you to believe the government couldn't have proved up these exhibits?
Well,
in other words, there's government say, well, you know, everybody knows these are the exhibits. Okay, if you want to take up the time, we'll bring in these people to testify to it. There isn't any substantial question about these exhibits, actually, is there?
Well, Judge, I think the point is government has a burden of proof.
If I understand all that, but you've got to show that you are prejudiced by the counsel's failure to object. Now, people who try cases many times don't object to evidence they know that can be proved up.
That may be, Your Honor, I think the point is, what is, how was she prejudiced? Well, she was prejudiced by the government arguing during closing that in reference to these exhibits.
You don't understand my question, so just go on.
Yes, sir. I think the other issues that I wanted to address today were issues at sentencing. In particular, the two-level enhancement for conscious or serious bodily injury related to the offense. The sentencing judge adopted the pre-sentence investigation report and found that Ms. Rogers' conduct involved a conscious or reckless risk of death or serious bodily injury to the patients that were administered the physical therapy treatments. The basis for the court finding that was found in PSIR, and that was a Dr. Woodall. He had testified that non-licensed physical therapists, and I emphasize this point, could injure the patients who were being given physical therapy treatment. There was no testimony by Dr. Woodall that the techniques employed by these particular physical care, the business's employees, were in any way dangerous.
But when you utilize unlicensed people, you have no idea what kind of techniques they're going to use because they haven't had the training. Why do they require licensing of physical therapists?
Well, Your Honor, notwithstanding the fact that they weren't licensed, I think the point is there was no testimony, there was no evidence that techniques they used were dangerous. The government has to prove that those techniques are dangerous. They have to provide some evidence, not just that it could be dangerous, that it is dangerous.
Well, you know, that's sort of like saying if someone were allowing, let's say, a 10-year-old child to drive a vehicle, and maybe no wreck ensued and nobody was injured, so there was no danger involved just because it didn't happen to be an accident because the unlicensed a child was driving the car. And that, I think that's ridiculous.
Well, Judge, I believe that there has to be some evidence to substantiate it. Anything can happen. I mean, a sun can set or can rise in the east. When the government's proof is it could happen, that's not enough. They have to establish by preponderance of evidence for the judge to sustain that particular two-level enhancement.
And they have to show what? The risk of injury or actual injury?
Just the risk of injury, Your Honor. And notwithstanding the fact that they weren't licensed, and I don't think there's a dispute that they weren't licensed, that's just not enough by itself.
Okay, well, I think it speaks for itself. If you're using unlicensed people, that there's a risk there.
Yes, Your Honor.
I just don't understand that point at all. Do you have any other issues that you want to talk about? You're almost out of time.
No, Your Honor.
All right, you've saved time for rebuttal, Mr. Brindle. Thank you. Mr. Barrett?
May it please the Court, Your Honor. My name is Peter Barrett. I represent the appellant, Wayne Rogers. I'm here with my co-counsel, William Barrett, who's also my law partner. The issues that I would like to address today, with the court's permission, have to do with Wayne Rogers being tried with his co-defendant, his wife, Mrs. Rogers. There are a lot of reasons that he should have been these cases should not ever have been tried together.
Well, you know what our case law says. It's people who are indicted together get tried together, and it's very hard to overcome that presumption.
I couldn't agree with Your Honor more. I understand what the case law says, but what we have here is the failure of the trial court to grant a severance in this case when it became apparent that there was testimony from the co-defendant that would exonerate Mr. Wayne Rogers.
When was the severance motion made?
The severance motion was initially made at the close of the government's case. The record is unclear about whether something was filed. I'm assuming that there was nothing written filed, because there's nothing in the record to support that.
Ordinarily, given the nature of this indictment and the allegations and so on and so forth, you know, we'd see a motion to settle early in the trial or pretrial, maybe renewed later, but with some predicate laid for it as to how the evidence might unfold. So here the severance motion comes deep into the case.
I agree with Your Honor.
Is there a written severance motion?
There was at least an oral tennis motion, an oral motion made.
There was that, but is there a written severance motion in the record?
It does not appear that there is. I have not found one in the record, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Getting back to your point, Your Honor, the severance motion, the court has a continuing duty to monitor whether there's prejudice to a defendant or not. I understand that a 12B motion, such as a severance motion, should be made pre-trial. But there's room under 12E for the court to grant for good cause to let someone file a motion and to entertain a motion for a severance anytime that prejudice appears. During the trial, in this case, the prejudice was that my client, Mr. Wayne Rogers, was prejudiced by the fact that he was not able to put on the testimony of his co-defendant, Mrs. Rogers, who was one of the managers is the person that actually hired him at this outfit called PPM, I believe it's Primary Physical Medicine.
But you're arguing that the trial judge should have sua sponte severed this case as the evidence is unflowing, is flowing? I mean, is your argument that the judge should have noted the need for severance, you know, in the midst of the evidence unfolding and the absence of a written severance motion and this just kind of occurring in the middle of trial?
I don't think the court should have sui sponte, but I think the court should at least have entertained the motion and given analysis and analyzed the affidavit that was before the court. And I understand it was unsworn, and that's unfortunate, but there was clearly something there, and despite the government's protestations otherwise, it was not conclusory in nature. It starts out that I believe it's in record excerpts, Wayne Rogers' record excerpts, and I believe it's at number 9 in Wayne Rogers' record excerpts. But at any rate, the substance of the statement, which is in fact signed and was submitted to the court and is in the record excerpt, was that she was willing to testify but not at her own trial. If there were separate trials, she would testify. She would offer this man a complete defense. She gave specifics of what she was willing to do because she said that she would testify as to what Wayne Rogers reasonably believed, and because of what Jim Hull Davis, who was the mastermind of this operation, had represented to her and had represented to Mr. Rogers with respect to the legality of what they were doing.
But didn't she basically refuse to say that she would testify?
I don't know whether she said that. I don't think she said
she
that.
Say one word. The way she came down, the bottom line was, maybe I will.
Well, without the admonition or the advice or whatever you want to call it from the district judge, that wouldn't have happened. Recall what he reminded the court.
She was present in court. I mean, her counsel or his could ask her, you know, or whatever. But as I understand, basically she just refused to say whether she would testify or not. She indicated she might.
I don't believe that was, well, maybe there's confusion in the record, Your Honor, but the way I read it and the way I saw it, she was willing to testify until that moment when the district judge called her lawyer aside and advised him that she might lose acceptance of responsibility.
Of course she might. That was wasn't that true?
Barely. I mean, it was true. It was but it was not much of a consideration. The guidelines themselves say that if you go to trial, you lose acceptance. I mean, there's a possibility out.
You go ahead and finish your answer.
There's a possibility out there that she could have lost acceptance, but I'm familiar with a little familiar with the law in this circuit, and I'm a little familiar with that trial judge, and I don't know of any case in which there has been acceptance granted after a trial.
She might have. I mean, if she's going to get and testify in his trial, and she's going to say, you know, it was me who was doing it, not him. He was innocent. All right. Then she's going to want to bump into, obviously thinking at least of the possibility of a plea.
May I answer?
Yeah. Sure.
Your Honor, what she was going to do is testify until the judge intervened. And it was that unfortunate intervening by the judge that caused her not to swear to the affidavit, but that really shouldn't make any difference. He offered the proof that was necessary to get him past that hurdle so that he could so that the court could see its way clear to grant the severance to allow her to testify and to exonerate him specifically with respect to the activities of Jim Davis Hull and what he advised him of.
All right. Thank you. Your initial time has expired, Mr. Barrett. You've saved time for rebuttal.
I believe I saved 3 minutes. Yeah, thank
yes, you did. Uh-huh. Mr. Cleveland?
Good morning, Your Honors. Gaines Cleveland for the United States. Let me touch on the points that counsel has raised and the court has raised questions about as well, very briefly. First, on this issue of severance, this really is a claim. The severance claim is too little, too late. It was not made formally until the close of all the evidence. Wayne Rogers proffered this unsworn affidavit of La Tanisha that she ultimately was unwilling to swear out. This is a situation like that in United States against Pedroza, which is cited in our brief at page 29, authored by Judge Stewart, where the defendant failed to satisfy the co-defendant's willingness to testify on his behalf. This court has said that the timeliness of the motion is a factor, and that's in the Ramirez case cited in our brief at page 28. Here it is a significant factor. The case had come to a complete close, and there was, of course, this uncertainty as to whether La Tanisha Rogers would even testify at all. And the government did characterize the affidavit as conclusory in its brief, and I think that's appropriate. There are conclusory statements about what prospective witness would say, including that Wayne did not know he had to be a licensed physical therapist. That's on page court exhibit C1. And so how can she say what he did not know? I mean, these are things that are not this is simply not the reason to stop the trial, sever a defendant late in the game. As to the other points.
Well, she was obviously the ringleader, though, and she just brought him in.
That's correct.
Not telling him what was going on, just say you do this, you know.
Well,
then I mean, that's if that's his defense, I can see why, he might want to present that defense. But it didn't seem to me that it was entirely clear that she was going to do that.
That's exactly right. And ultimately, she was not willing to do so.
Because she would hang herself, basically. I mean.
Right. I think her own credibility with the court, whether from the standpoint of acceptance of responsibility or just in any vantage point, is obviously damaged if she gets up and says things that are patently not true. On the evidentiary point that Mr. Brendel raised, this Cahaba program is designated by Congress as part of its Medicare program. This is described in our brief at page 40. The Medicare program is administered through private contractors. This Cahaba program is one of the private contractors. They have access to all of the materials of the Medicare program. They use those. The providers rely on information that is given to them by programs like Cahaba. And the witness in this case was simply sponsoring documents that were kept in the ordinary course of their business. There was not any ineffective assistance of counsel in failing to object. Judge Smith, in an opinion cited in our brief, page 41 in the Armstrong case, pointed out there's no requirement that the witness who lays the foundation be the author of the record. The record, as far as the harm to the patients, was developed at trial, for both through an expert witness on behalf of the government, Dr. Woodall, whose testimony at page 783 of the transcript and following is cited in our brief, talks about the dangers of something called E-STEM, which is one of the procedures that were formed, and contraindications for E-STEM, that it's like the potential of being shocked. There's also potential of affecting a person's heart rate, causing a burn to the patient. That's page 785 of the transcript. They were administering ultrasound, which creates heat, can potentially burn a patient, cause a deep burn. The can also be applied to a cancerous lesion and can cause complications for the patient.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
What was the, in a snapshot, what was the defense in this case?
There was an effort to try to say that they've mentioned him before, Jim Davis Hall was the ringleader. And so they went after Jim Davis Hall, who was one of the people who was behind these physical medicine companies. There are several cases that have been before this court involving companies that he helped start. So they did a lot of pointing the finger at him.
So it was no knowledge?
Right.
I mean, obviously the facts of what transpired were not in dispute. So the defense was no intent of the fraud, no awareness that it was wrong?
They tried to mount a good faith of reliance on him, but there was nobody who testified that from the standpoint of either of these defendants as to what that they relied in any way on Jim Davis Hall. And there's plenty of proof to show that they themselves had knowledge sufficient to be able to be.
Right. So on the defense side, neither of the defendants testified?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, so who were the defense witnesses at all?
There was one of the defense witnesses was one of the doctors who was they tried to show that he relied on Jim Davis Hall, and therefore if he relied on Jim Davis Hall, then maybe everybody else relied on Jim Davis Hall.
Okay, the this argument counsel made initially about ineffective assistance of counsel. Counsel below, were they court appointed? And was this issue raised any time before the appeal in post-trial motions about ineffective counsel?
It was not couched in an ineffective assistance of counsel form. There was a post-trial motion and a post-trial ruling that's in the record from Judge Jecks on the evidentiary issue, but it was not couched in terms of ineffective assistance of counsel. I do have my page of the brief, page 15, which just says that the only defense witness was Robin Morris, who's one of the Medicare billers for the program, who explained the procedures and who said that Jim Davis Hall purportedly told her, told the billers, don't worry about the legalities of these things, he would take care of it, and to pretty much do your job, which is to bill. In cross-examining a government witness who was a doctor, the counsel for the defense tried to suggest that the doctor was relying on the advice of this Jim Davis Hall.
Well, let me ask you one other question, shifting gears to the sentencing.
Yes.
I mean, it is a pretty big gap between what Hull got and he got his sister off and all of that, and then what these defendants got. Some is a theory that, putting aside their pointing the finger that he was culpable, but there's a pretty big gap there. So was the government's theory. I mean, they were more culpable in terms of the amount of money, the amount of fraud, et cetera, et cetera.
He was well first in the door in exposing this whole situation. He became a cooperating defendant very early on and ended up testifying in a couple of trials and responsible for the eviction of at least four defendants.
Right.
And that's
so he became a prime mover.
That's correct.
And not just these two.
That's correct.
But in several other cases.
That's correct.
So he was able to cut a deal more favorable because the government could use him in a multiplicity of ways.
That's correct.
He pleaded guilty.
He pled guilty early on. And I think I was here about this time last year arguing the Crawley case, which is referred to in our brief, and he was a testifying cooperating defendant in that case as well. That's all I have to say.
Because it doesn't look like you needed him per se to convict them. Is that it?
I think he helped.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Cleveland. Mr. Rendell, you've saved time for a vote.
I'd like to first address the gross disparities in sentences between some of the co-defendants and others similarly situated. I think as Judge Stewart mentioned earlier, Jim Davis Hull received a sentence of 5 years. There was also a jury trial involving similar facts, a Medicare fraud case. One of the co-defendants, Ms. Hull, was actually the wife of Jim Davis Hull. She received a sentence of 10 years, and she went to trial just like Ms. Rogers did, and Ms. Rogers' sentence was almost 16 years. And I submit that these disparities in sentences are so disproportionate based on similar types of contact. In fact, the base level offense, and this is in the brief for Ms. Crawley and Ms. Hull, the base level offense was calculated to be the same. I think it was 32. At any rate, you have Jim Davis Hull. He was an attorney. This was an attorney in Moss Point who, from the trial testimony, even though there was one witness, the one witness testified we were doing what Jim Davis Hull told us to do. And you have other non-attorneys who worked with him and underneath him.
Well, this was sentenced at the very bottom of the range, right?
Pardon me, Your Honor.
This was at the bottom of the sentencing range, wasn't it? The lowest level of the sentencing range.
For Ms. Rogers?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. But nonetheless, I would point out that I think there's a gross disparity of sentences. The other issue that I wanted to raise was the two-level enhancement, again, for the conscious disregard or the injury that Ms. Rogers was given a two-level enhancement for. I believe that the issue was there any testimony by Dr. Shepherd? That's what the government relied on for the two-level enhancement. Was there any testimony that anything that the non-licensed physical therapist did was wrong? And I think the U.S. Attorney just mentioned that you can be injured from ultrasound, you can be injured from the kind of treatment you can. Well, you could be injured from that by virtue of a medical doctor performing or a licensed physical therapist performing it.
But you can be injured if you have an operation, a medical doctor can injure you. But we would say that you can't let a child operate.
That's true. You can't let you can't have a child operate, but notwithstanding that fact, you still have absolutely no evidence that what they did or how they did it or who they did it to. There's nothing of that in the record.
But the wording is risk of injury. An untrained person may not know what procedures to undertake or how long or how extensive to do those procedures. So the risk surely is there if they're unlicensed.
And that's true, Your Honor, but it's a degree of risk. We never heard testimony about the degree of risk from any techniques that they used. And I see my time's up.
Yes, your time's up. Thank you, Mr. Brindle. Mr. Barrett, you've saved time also for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, the government's counsel has pointed to the fact that allegation that the motion that was filed, and it clearly was filed. I mean, it's clear in the record that at least there was an Ora Tennis motion for severance, but that it was untimely, and for that reason, the court ought to disregard any argument with respect to that. And I think I've already pointed out to the court that the district judge, even under Rule 12, has the power to or has the authority to use his discretion and for good cause shown to allow an untimely motion. I don't think that's an impediment to it. The counsel for the government also said that the affidavit seems to indicate that Mrs. Rogers was testify about what Mr. Rogers did not know, and I don't believe that that's the import of it at all. I believe the import of her affidavit, signed but unsworn, was that she would testify with respect to matters relating to what he knew from Jim Davis Hull. Now, that, you know, maybe on further analysis, if the court had gone ahead and analyzed the document, instead of avoiding having to analyze the document by simply saying it's unreliable because it's unsworn, you know, that deprives this court and deprives us of the that deprives us of the opportunity to at least have the analysis of the document about whether or not it is sufficient under Pedroza and sufficient under, I believe the court cited Neal. But at any rate, It was clear that she was doing something more than just making a general statement that she would exonerate him.
What would happen if the court had granted the motion?
For severance?
Yeah.
Well, then presumably there would have been a second trial of
her trial would have continued.
Her trial would have continued.
And she would then have testified. His trial would have been declared a mistrial.
I believe so. His trial would have been declared a mistrial, and then he would have been granted a new trial at which she would testify.
If she wanted to. Because they could not force her to testify. She's got a right against self-incrimination as long as her appeal's pending, claiming she's entitled to a new trial, because these errors.
I don't disagree with Your Honor, but that's a what if, and we don't know. We haven't been there yet. We're not going to know till we get there. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Your case is under submission. Mr. Brindle and Mr. Barrett.